נויכי השם אלוהיכך, אשר הוצאתיך מארץ מצרים מבית עבדים. I am the Lord your God, Hashem says. This pencil is not going like it. I am the Lord your God, who took you out of, who brought you out of Egypt, mibeis avodim, from the house of slavery. I'd like to talk to you about tonight about if we can get through it, about a number of different parts to this pasuk. In one of the first declarations that Hashem makes to Avram Avinu, he says to Avram Avinu, Ani Hashem. Parshas Lech Lecha, he announces himself to Avram. Vayemer Elov, Ani Hashem Asher Hitzeisicha Miur Kazdim. So you see, there's a certain correlation here. Here he says to Avram Avinu, I am Hashem, Asher Hitzeisicha Miur Kazdim. I am God who took you out of Ur Kazdim. The only difference, and here too, Asher Hitzeisicha Miur Kazdim, here he talks about the fact that he brought us out of Egypt, and there he tells Avram, I took you out of Ur Kazdim. And according to some, Ur Kazdim was the incident with this furnace that Nimrod cast him into. The only major distinction between this declaration and the declaration of the Aser Sadibres is that in the first case, Hashem said, Ani Hashem, and over here he said, Anoichi Hashem. So we have two words, Ani, which means I, and Anoichi, which means I. So what's the difference? Or is there a difference? Why does one sometimes use Ani and sometimes we use Anoichi? So the Sefer Haksav HaKabbalah makes the following assertion about the significance of Ani and Anoichi. When you use the word Ani, the important thing over there is not so much the subject, but the verb. For example, if I were to say, Ani Oimed, I am standing. So if I say Ani Oimed, the major emphasis is I am standing, not sitting, not running, not walking. I'm standing. The main feature over here is the way in which the verb tells you something about the subject. The main focus is the verb. If I tell you Anochi Oimed, then I'm telling you I am standing, as opposed to everybody else. In other words, important part here is not the verb. The important part is on myself. For example, he says that when Hashem comes to say to Cain, where is Hevel? So he says to him, Hashem er ochi anechi. He says to him, am I my brother's keeper? Am I my brother's shemer? He uses the word anechi, which is to say, am I my brother's watchman and not my father and mother? Why do you single me out? In other words, the focus is Anoichi as opposed to anybody else. Or he cites another example. When Hashem comes looking for Adam after the Chet, and Adam has concealed himself, he is hidden in the garden, so it says, Va'ira ki eraim Anoichi. And I was afraid because I was naked, or I am naked. So, Aksav HaKabbalah says that what Adam was saying, I saw all the animals. They have fur, they have feathers. I see myself as I am the only one who is naked. Nobody else is naked. I am naked, nobody else. In other words, the emphasis is I, in contrast to everybody else. Or, for example, he cites Leah. Leah, when she gives the names of her children, she says, Hashem saw ki snua anechi, that I am hated. I am snua. I, as opposed to Rachel. Rachel is ahuva. Rachel is beloved. I, as opposed, in other words, the emphasis is over here on the anechi. So he says that in the first case, when Hashem appeared to Avraham, Avraham did not know what Hashem's attributes were, who Hashem is, what is he. So the emphasis over there was Ani Hashem, which is to say Hashem meaning Hoyah Hoyah V'Yia. I am the God who always was, I am the God who is, I am the God who will be, I am the God who stands above time. Mehaveh Sakil, I am the God who manipulates everything, who sustains everything. What he was trying to tell him was adjectives, predicates about himself. Ani Hashem is a statement. I am not so much the I, but I want to tell you about myself. So there he uses the word Ani, because the emphasis is not on the Ani so much as it is the description of the Ani. Over here, Klal Yisrael already knows, they have a tradition, there is a Meseira, what Hashem is all about. Over here, Hashem's purpose is in saying, I and nobody else. So here Hashem says, Anochi Hashem, I and nobody else is Hashem. I am the only one who has these abilities, I am the only one who has these capacities. Anochi Hashem, I and nobody else. So for that reason, the pasuk over here, the declaration that Hashem makes is not Ani Hashem, because that belonged to an earlier period in history where Hashem had to describe his attributes. There it was appropriate to say Ani Hashem. Over here, when he means to rule out, to exclude all other forces, all other entities, I and no other, then the appropriate word is Anochi Hashem. The generations that preceded Maimed HaSinai had amongst them generations that were idolatrous. So beginning from the time of Enosh, there was Avodah Zarah. But it's important to understand that when Avodah Zarah began, when idolatry began, that it did not begin as some crass act of stupidity. It wasn't some savage, primitive mind that decided to worship the sun and the moon and molten or graven images. The Rambam describes that the intent of earlier generations was, from one perspective, was actually a fairly sensible approach. The earlier generations reasoned twofold, according to the Rambam. The logic of idolatry was that the sun and the moon and the heavenly constellations all represent very lofty, sublime entities. They are gods, as it were, God's ministers. These are creations that God made, which are of a higher nature than the lower creations. And just as one would honor the ministers of the king, for example, if the king sends out an emissary, a secretary of state, a vice president, someone who represents the kingdom, so it's understood that he would be very angry and very distraught if his emissary would be treated with disrespect. because his emissary represents the throne in much the same way that it is a supreme insult to trample the flag, because the flag is not a piece of cloth. It represents a government. It represents the system by which a society is run. So if you trample on the flag, you're making a statement about the government, and it's an insult against the government. So they reasoned that the sun and the moon and the stars were God's chosen emissaries. Certainly, there is a whole science about astrology, and the astrological forces assert some influence on the affairs of people, and the Gemara substantiates that there are that people who are born in the certain constellations are influenced in certain directions, not bound, not constrained or totally defined, but influenced by them. So they reasoned that for them to give honor to those constellations, to the sun and the moon and so on, was really an act of deference and respect to the King of Kings, to the master of the world. That was one reason that people began bowing to the moon and to the stars, giving deference.
Did you say that they recognized Hashem and they were just...
Yes, definitely. They recognized Hashem. This was, and initially, they felt that they were doing honor to Hashem by doing this. There was a second logic. The second logic is cited by other commentaries, that people said to themselves, the Almighty is so holy, he is so great, he is so removed from the trivial pursuits of people, that it is unbecoming of me. How dare I? How do I have the temerity to approach God and to imagine that I have the right to pray to God? I have the right to serve God. Who am I? I am a finite being. I have many flaws, many blemishes, many shortcomings. It's not for me to do so. In other words, if, again, to borrow the example, if some peasant were just to stroll into the throne room of the king and to say, I want to talk to the king, would be a big chutzpah. Want to talk to the king, first you got to talk to the whoever is your legislator in your own province. Let them talk to their superior. Eventually it'll reach a certain, and if there's merit to your request, then some ranking minister will come and present your request to the king. What are you walking? Who are you? What are you? What recommends you to be able to come in to speak to the king? So they reasoned that it was out of respect to God, that it was just a supreme chutzpah for them to imagine that they and God could be in the same place, talking to one another, interacting. They had that they would have any right to approach God. And so they reasoned that there should be some intermediary who is more worthy of presenting the needs of the lower beings to the master of the world. So they took an idolatry, not because they didn't believe in God, but because they didn't believe that they had a right to approach God. The flaw in the logic of these two is that for an infinite God, the distance between the infinite and the finite is always infinite. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about the sun, or you're talking about something which is 100 million times greater than the sun, or you're talking about the slightest speck in the universe. In terms of distance, between the finite and the infinite, it is always infinite. What's the difference, let us say, and if you want to take something, two things that are finite, you can say, what's the difference between 1 and 10 or 5 and 10? Obviously, the greater something is, the shorter the disparity, the shorter the distance. But what's the difference between something which is 1 and infinity? It's an infinite discrepancy. What's the difference between 1 million and something which is infinite? It's still infinite. So for man to say, I have no right to approach God, there is something which is more appropriate, is not to understand this basic principle. And conversely, if God introduced intelligence into my being and made me aware of his presence, then I have as much a right as anything else in the universe, with my shortcomings, to present myself to the Almighty without recourse to any mediation. It's nice for me to be reverent. It is nice to me to be aware of my place. But for me to suggest that there is something that is more appropriate to appear in the presence of God is to suggest that God is something less than infinite. And therefore, there is less of a distance. But there is no. There is no, neither in quantity or quality or whatever. It's still infinite. The distinction or the flaw in the argument that it is appropriate to honor God's servants, the argument which the Rambam uses to explain idolatry in the time of Enosh, that's the beginning of it, and the Rambam explains that's the way idolatry began, and from there, it gradually became less and less clear that people were actually trying to give honor to God by giving honor to God's servants, and eventually they forgot about God, and they were just giving honor to the sun and to the moon. So, the flaw in that argument, in the initial argument, I mean, obviously later on when people are just worshiping the sun and the moon, there's a big, big mistake going on. Great, there's a massive error here. But what is the real flaw in what they started out doing? Why shouldn't they, in fact, give honor to God's servants, who are Shamoshai, Hamishamshin, Lefonai, Bamorim? These are the servants who serve on high. It would seem that would be an expression of respect and honor to God, to honor God's servants. There is a note. For example, we learn that Uriah Hachiti, the first husband of Bathsheba, was a Murid B'Malchus. He was considered as someone who was rebellious against the throne. One of the citations of his disrespect for the throne was the fact that when he was referring to Yoav. When he was referring to Yoav in the presence of the king of David HaMelech, that he called himself, if I remember correctly, there was this something, he called himself the servant of Yoav. And in the presence of the king, you can't call yourself anybody else's servant but the servant of the king. And the same thing is true in the halacha. If there is a Talmud and a Rav, let us say that you enter a room, and in the room there is a teacher, and there is the teacher's disciple. you are not permitted to honor the disciple in the presence of the Rav. That is considered a disrespect to the Rav. To give deference to any of the heavenly bodies, or for that matter, anything else in the universe, with the intent that thereby you are honoring God, is to forget the fact that wherever any of these heavenly bodies is, God is. You're always in the throne room. There is no such place in the world where God is not and they are. For example, when the king sends out an emissary and the king's palace is in Washington, and he sends out an emissary to California. The king is in Washington. The emissary appears in California. There, people who meet the king's emissary should show respect. This is a delegate. It is a representative of the throne. But if the king joins the delegate, the emissary, and travels with him, and then somebody goes and bows to the emissary while the king is standing there and neglects the king, that is an act of disrespect to the throne. Wherever the sun is, God is. Wherever the moon is, God is. Wherever the heavenly constellations is, God is there. There is nothing, there is no place, there is no entity in the universe which occupies a space where God is not. So to give covet, to act reverently or worshipfully to the heavenly bodies or any other natural phenomenon, in an attempt to give honor to God, is to suggest that God is not there at that moment. And that ultimately leads to idolatry. One of the Mefarshim argues that for that reason there is a difference between the way in which we address all of the sages of the Talmud. In the Gemara, for example, we say Rebbe Meir, Rebbe Akiva, Rebbe Chanina ben Tradion, we say Rebbe first. By Moshe, we don't say Rabbeinu Moshe, we say Moshe Rabbeinu. And they argue that Moshe Rabbeinu's place was factually always in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. For someone to address Moshe by saying Rabbeinu first would be a misunderstanding or an act of respect in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And you had to move off the Rabbeinu until after you said his name. To say Rabbeinu first would be to miss the point that Moshe was, he was standing right in front of God at the time. You can't give kavod to the Talmud in the Mokim of the Rav. The Rav is right there. When Hashem comes to tell us about the fact that we should make no mistake about the way in which he relates to human beings, one of the first principles that he wants us to know is an argument against that second position. Second position says that the reason that one worships the astrological constellations is because we are not worthy of having a relationship with God. And Hashem says to us, Anochi Hashem Lekecho, I am the Lord your God, Asher Hoitzeisicho mi Eretz Mitzrayim mi Beis Avodim. I came to get you in the dungeons. I came to get you in the worst conditions, in the most inhumane distant, perverted conditions. I came to get you in an Eretz Temea. I came to get you in a land which was full of all forms of spiritual corruption, all forms of spiritual contamination, in a place that had 50 gates of Tumah. He had to get us out of there because we were already in the 49th and we could easily have slipped into the 50th. But there were 50 gates of Tumah there. And in the Beis Avodim, I came to get you in a situation and in a human condition which was the furthest from that in which God's presence, it should be argued, belonged. God's presence didn't belong in that schmutz. So I'm telling you, Anoichi Hashem Lekecha, Asher Hitzeisicha Mi'eretz Mitzrayim Mi'Beis Avodim, and there is nothing that should come between myself and all of you. And don't argue that there should be some intermediary, because it is unbecoming of man to appear in God's presence, because I came to get you. And I came to get you in conditions which should tell you once and for all that these things do not matter, that the discrepancy, the disparity between myself and all things is infinite. And I have a special interest in man. There is a Mechilta. In the Mechilta, the Mechilta talks about this this first declaration, the first statement that Hashem makes. Anichi Hashem Lekecha. So the Mechilta says as follows. Anichi Hashem Lekecha. Mipnei ma'alei nemru aseres hadibros betchilas ha-Torah. Why doesn't the Torah begin with the aseres hadibros? It should begin with the Ten Commandments. It starts with Bereshis and tells us a story about Avram Avinu and Lech Lecha and Yitzchak and Yankiv and the Shvatim and Yosef and so on. Why doesn't it start? The Torah should start with Anechi Hashem. That's really the beginning of the Torah in terms of giving us a code by which we are to conduct our lives. So last week, I think it was last week, we spoke about the fact that the Sefer Bereshis, wasn't last week, 2 weeks ago, that the Sefer Bereshis tells us about the kind of character which is a necessary preface for accepting and building Torah. Here, the Medrash Mechilta says as follows, Mashlu Mashal, Lama Davadayma. How are we to see? This is a parable. That is, a parable will help us understand this. Le'echad shenichnas b'medina, a fellow came into a country, amalhem emlech aleichem, and he said to them, would you want me to be your king? Amrulai, so they said to him, kluma sisa lanu shetimlech aleinu, did you ever do anything for us that you should wish to be our king, or that we should take you as our king? Ma'os alayhem. So what did this fellow do? He built them walls. He brought them water. He waged war on their behalf. And when he finished doing these things, Amar lahem, so he said to them, Emlech aleichem? Shall I now be your king? Amrulay, hein vehein. So they said, yes, certainly. Now we want you to be our king. Kach ha-moker. Similarly, same thing is true of God. Ha-yitzi Yisrael mi-Mitzrayim, he took them out of Egypt, and he split the sea, and he brought them on, and he gave them the well, that the spring that gave them water. He brought the slav for them. He waged war with Amalek. Amalahem. So he says to them now, Emlech aleichem? May I be your king? Shall I be your king? And will I? Hein vehein. So they said to him, yes, now we agree. I think that the questions that this raises are very obvious. What is there in this parable which is in any way to be seen as a parallel to Matan Torah, or that is to give us some insight into what was going on here? Here a guy comes into a kingdom, he's a total stranger, and he comes in and he says, how would you like me to be your king? So obviously they should say to him, what for? They have a right to say to him, what are you going to do for us?
Be serious.
Huh?
Be serious.
That's right. But what would happen if somebody marches in with a huge army, right, and nuclear weapons, and says, how would you like me to be your king? I mean, does anybody hang around there saying, what are you going to do for us? I mean, it's nonsense. This person is going to say, how would you like to lose your head? I mean, what's the who would dare make that statement? Somebody walks in with a huge army and all kinds of nuclear weapons. You say, oh, yeah, sure, we'd just love for you to be our king. We can't wait. God is not a stranger to the universe. And if God comes along and says, and we know it's God talking, he says, how would you like me to be your king? I mean, he's making us an offer we can't refuse. What? Wow, all right. So how are we to understand this parable? Second of all, this king gets this answer. Okay, we don't understand why there's any parallel here, but nonetheless, he gets this answer. And he goes out and he does all these things on behalf of this kingdom. And he builds walls and he brings in water and he wages war. And now he says to them, would you like me to be your king? And they said, yes. So similarly, somehow, we have to understand that God also came along and said to them, in some shape, form, or manner, should I be your king? And they say to him, well, what have you done for us? And so God goes out and does all these things. And now we're willing for him to be our king. But does it necessarily have to be that he took us out of Egypt? Or if God's point was that he wanted to be our king, so then in fact he could have spared us all the trouble of going down to Egypt, should have put us into the land of Israel, given us a nice country, and then come along and said, would you like nice crops? Would you like rain in the right season? Would you like that the weather should be good? Would you like that your enemies shouldn't attack you? And that would have been a good offer. And for that offer, we would have also exchanged our system of government for his kingship. Was it necessary that we would have to go down into Egypt and suffer all of this pain and torture, all of this bondage, and then God takes us out? And all of this for the purpose that when he comes along and asks us if we are interested in his being our king, that we would agree. And why in the first place, to go back to our initial question, didn't God just come along and say, forget the whole business, you're it, finished.
You are the chosen people,
I chose you. So there are a number of very important messages and principles which this Mechilta is coming to impress upon us. In the first instance, what it wants us to understand is that what took place at Har Sinai was not a king who appears with nuclear weapons and a gigantic army. That this was not an offer that we couldn't refuse. If that would be the case, there is another word, not melech, but meishel. There are two words that imply governing or ruling. One is meishel, a ruler, and one is melech, meaning a king. The difference between a meishel and a melech is that a meishel rules by force. A melech rules by choice. A meishel comes in and overwhelms and overpowers and says, I am the boss. Might is the source of my authority. Power is the source of my authority. It doesn't matter whether you like it or not, I am the ruler. That's a meishel. What this medrash wants us to understand is that God did not descend upon Har Sinai and say, you must accept my rule. That what it was a strange kavyochel, as though it were, just like a strange person who comes in and asks a kingdom, do you want me to be your king? In other words, it's an elective process. It is not a show of force, but it is, do you find merit? Do you elect to have me as your king? It's, Emlech Aleichem, shall I be your king? Do you choose it? Now, God certainly could have done it the other way, and we need to understand what Kafa Aleim Ahar is when he swings the mountain ball, and that's a second chapter. That's a second rung in this whole thing. But it doesn't begin that way. It doesn't begin with his swinging the mountain. It begins with the question of, will they say Nasa V'Nishma? Are they going to elect to have me as their king? That's where it begins. And the reason that that is a necessary cornerstone of Matan Torah is because the hallmark of a human being and the purpose of creation is man exercising Bechira. It is a human being using his free will to choose. Everything else in the universe does not have the capacity to choose. Bechira is a uniquely human capacity. And it is for the purpose of Bechira that man was created by God. It was for that reason that the world was created in the way it was created, with the tension between good and evil. And man was given a constitution, as it were, that was drawn in both directions with equal intensity. And man must exercise his rights and prerogatives to choose to define himself and his life. If Maimed Har Sinai, which is the turning point in history, would have been an act that would have ignored this basic human capacity, then it would have meant that the reason that the world revolves and exists is a product of force and not choice. And the world must exist if the purpose of creation is to be realized, it must exist because man chooses it to exist. For that reason, when it says Yom HaShishi, in the description of creation, every day is Yom, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi. By the sixth day, it says Yom HaShishi, that we are told by our sages that Yom HaShishi means the sixth day of Sivan, not the sixth day of creation, but the sixth day of Sivan. That the world was not complete until the sixth day of Sivan, when Klal Yisrael accepted the Torah, which meant that if Klal Yisrael had chosen to reject the Torah, that the world would have dissolved into nothingness. Since Klal Yisrael chose to embrace the Torah, that is when the world was finally complete. Yom HaShishi is when the world, when creation finally was completed. So all of creation, not just the individual human being, but all of creation must be a product of the choice that mankind exercises. And to the extent that Atem Kriyim Ladam, that Klal Yisrael is the nation who alone merits this term of Adam, Klal Yisrael had to exercise the choice whether or not the world had a reason to exist. So the question is not God appearing in force or God overwhelming Klal Yisrael. God comes in much the same way as the parable suggests and asks, Emlech Aleichem, do you want me to rule over you? This is your choice, it's your prerogative, and you shall elect it. That is point number one. And the Medrash Mechilta is trying to tell us that is the meaning of Anochi Hashem Elokecha. That the meaning of Anochi Hashem Elokecha is, I am Hashem Elokecha, whom you chose to be your God. That's the starter. Not I am the Lord your God, whether you like it or not, but Elokecha means that I derive my right to rule, my authority, so to speak, over you by your choice. You chose me. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am Hashem, your God, whom you chose. You chose me to be your God. You elected. That's point number one that the Medrash Mechilta wants us to understand. Then the Mechilta wants us to understand something further. There are two variations on the theme of choice. For example, B.F. Skinner wanted us to believe that man was nothing more than a very complex animal. And if you put, for example, as he did in many of his experiments with mice, and he had what was called the Skinner box. And he would have, there would be a corridor, a long corridor, and then, I don't know, long, whatever, there was a corridor, and then he would have different branches going off of that corridor, and the rat or the mouse could go to one side or the other. And he tried different experiments with different kinds of rewards and different kinds of punishments to see whether or not these little animals would recognize what the choices were and opt to make one choice as opposed to another choice. And he did all kinds of experiments with different schedules of reward and so on. Implicit in B.F. Skinner's experimentation was that man basically operates in the same way. That there are all of these options in life, and that man learns over his lifetime which ones are painful, which ones are pleasurable, which ones are punitive, and which ones are rewarding, and that when faced with different options, man will choose the more pleasurable option. So To Skinner, the meaning of choice was really preference. Man really did not have absolute choice. There was no such thing as man choosing something which was unpredictable. You could, if you just knew enough about him, you could predict exactly what he would choose, just as you could predict what a mouse would choose. Because all human choice was nothing more than reward and punishment. It was a preference for one thing over another. When we talk about, when Judaism talks about free will, when we talk about choice, what we are suggesting is that man can choose something which is beyond himself, which may in fact be very uncomfortable, which may involve a great deal of deprivation, a great deal of discipline, that man has the capacity to understand things and sense things in a way which will allow him to choose something that is beyond, really, beyond the animal. The animal would choose, would make choices that would be consistent with preference, with reward and punishment. Man is capable of making decisions that go beyond reward and punishment and addresses issues of value in principle, even at great cost and pain to himself. There were two major dimensions about civilization as it was articulated in Egypt. Our sages tell us that until Yetzias Mitzrayim, until Jews went out of Egypt, that it never happened that a slave escaped Egypt. Never happened. And here, all of a sudden, the floodgates opened and millions poured out. But until that point, not a single slave ever escaped Egypt. And I suspect that we can accept that literally, that it never happened because Egypt operated by rules that were extraordinary, that were supernatural. There was a great deal of sorcery and magic which appealed to the darker forces of the universe, and that it's entirely possible and conceivable that they cast such spells or what have you that made it impossible for anyone to ever escape Egyptian slavery. However, I'm inclined to believe that in addition to that, that there is a broader understanding, one which might even allow for the fact that there were physically people who escaped the geographical confines of Egypt. And what it's trying to tell us is that Egypt had a system of slavery which was so powerful that when they were through with you, that it didn't matter where you went, you were never free again. It battered your personality and your ego to the point where you could never again live without someone telling you what to do, without someone directing your life, without someone thinking on your behalf. That it robbed you, it battered you to the point where you became a dependent, slavish personality. So even if people got out, someone successfully escaped Egypt, and they went 1,000 miles away, and they lived God knows where. They, no slave ever really got out of Egypt in much the same sense as that cigarette commercial goes. You can take Marlboro out of the country, you can't take the country out of Marlboro. You can't take the slave out of somebody who was in Egypt. The slave goes with them wherever they are. So they may have left the confines, but they remained slaves. That was one major defining characteristic about slavery in Egypt. That, and by the way, you see it in other things too. And you see it in families. There are families that go on for generations with creating battered syndrome. It just goes on. Battered children become battering parents, and that's because that's the only way in which they can relate. And frequently that's true of addiction. It just gets passed on from generation to generation. Well, here was a country that passed on slavery. It battered people until they could no longer function alone, could no longer stand on their own and live on their own. The second aspect was not so much of an emotional or mental state as it was a spiritual state. Egypt had a way of life which was steeped in zima, in immorality, in perversion, in pursuing the darkest, basest, most vulgar dimensions of people's character. It appealed to everything in people that was lustful, animalistic, violent, degrading. It was a country of darkness. It was a country of nun sharitum. It was a country in which the power of the forces of immorality was virtually total. To the point where people were, even the master race of Egypt, were totally submissive to their passions, to their appetites, to their animalistic and base inclinations. There was no way in which these people could have extricated themselves so deep and so constraining was the force of evil. When Israel's reflected upon their condition, they saw themselves as doubly shackled. They were, in the first place, they saw themselves as hopelessly enslaved. They recognized in themselves that they could never exist on their own, that they had been so battered, so dehumanized, so brutalized, that there was no way in which they would ever trust themselves to think, to decide, to act on their own. They recognized that for all practical intents and purposes, they were slaves, no matter where they would be, that they were slaves. And it didn't matter if they were in Egypt or elsewhere, they would still be slaves. They might as well be in Egypt. That if they'd be out in the desert, they'd still be slaves. Tzion says that's what the Haggadah means. And if the Almighty hadn't taken us out, we'd still be slaves. Because that's That's what we would be. That's what we would pass on. We couldn't teach anything other than what we were. We also recognized that that we had been exposed to the seamiest, the lowest aspect of life, and we saw ourselves as hopelessly lost, even if it were possible for us to think on our own, but we were really, at this point, we were hopelessly enslaved by our appetites, by our subservience to these forces of darkness. What we challenged, this force, this entity, that came along and said, Emlech aleichem, shall I rule over you? Right? Now, this was an election here. The question was understood by Klal Yisrael to be, is there any point in this? Is there any point in our having a relationship with God? As though to say, is our relationship going to be just one of preference? In other words, are you going to see to it that that you'll think for us? Are you going to come along? Are you going to provide all our needs for us so that we don't have to, that we don't have to stand on our own feet? Will you provide all of the needs for our appetites? Are you going to give us the wherewithal to let our passions run undisciplined, unbridled? Is that, in other words, are you here just to give us preferences? The divine response was, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord, your God, whom you chose for the following reasons. Asher Hayitzeicha mi'eretz Mitzrayim, I extricated you from the tumah of the land of Egypt. I took you out of, I showed you, I demonstrated to you that despite your conviction that you could never escape your habituation to your tivus, to your passions, I showed you that not just the geographical Eretz Mitzrayim. I took you out of the tumah of Eretz Mitzrayim. You were about to fall into the abyss of the 50th tumah, and I took you, I lifted you above all of that. I showed you it can be done. In other words, I showed you that a human being has the capacity, if they are attached to me, to make not a preferential choice, but a substantive choice to remove themselves in principle from the degradation of darkness and to choose to lift themselves into a level of a new plateau of light, of tahara, of kedusha.
What was the relationship with the Yavishter at this time? What did they know of this being?
They didn't.
They didn't know anything.
They knew very little, other than what they had received by a Mesera from Avram Avinu and Yitzchak and Yankiv, by what they had come down to them from the Ovis. And subsequently, what actually took place at Yitzias Mitzrayim. Yitzias Mitzrayim was a lesson. It was a lesson, twofold lesson. It was a lesson in, I can take you out of the Mem Teshari Tuma. And there was a second lesson. The second lesson was, Mi Beis Avodim. I can also, I have taken you out of Mi Beis Avodim. You believed that you would never again be able to think for yourself. You believed that you could never again act on your own. And Yetzias Mitzrayim exposed you to the fact that you still had the capacity to reclaim your independence. The reason the Medrash continues, as though to say, when this king comes along and makes this offer, Emlechalem, they said to him, Kluma Sisalanush Timlechalem, did you do anything for us that you should? In other words, the question in the parable, from the Mushal to the Nimshal, is that Klal Yisrael was saying, how can we choose anything unless you demonstrate to us that we are capable of choice? In which case, Hashem comes along and says, okay, here, I'm going to show you that I can take you out of Egypt. What's more, I'm going to show you that I am capable of manipulating all of the forces of nature. For which reason, it doesn't come along and say, as many of them question, why doesn't he come along and make a more impressive statement? Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God who created heaven and earth. That's much more impressive than taking them out of Egypt. Take them out of Egypt to say, Yesh mi yesh. It's just, I mean, here, it's moving around the chess pieces. But the world was created ex nihilo, was created from nothingness. That's a much more impressive achievement. So why don't you come along and say, I am the Lord because I created heaven and earth. But the creation of heaven and earth could be seen as the creation of nature. Nature is bound. It's bound by laws. There's laws of gravity. There's laws that apply, of cause and effect, and limitations to all of nature. Nature is constrained. The sun goes up. The sun sets. There's nothing which interrupts the rising and setting of the sun. There are certain things which must happen. To say Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Barasi does not talk about human choice. In fact, if he would come to us and talk to us about the fact that he wants to be our God because he created heaven and earth, we would say to him, so you're talking to us about preference. You want to relate to us in a world of preference, which is to say that you're going to give us, you're going to offer us protection, you're going to offer us pleasures and whatever, and so that's it. We're in a Skinner box. That's our relationship. Because just as nature is created by you and is locked into its order, so are we. There is no such thing as really a person choosing something that's beyond himself, that transcends himself. It's impossible. Because we're just part of the natural order. And all of these things that he talks about, he split the sea and he caused the month to fall, all of these things are events that transcend nature, that define nature. And what he was coming along and was saying to Klal Yisrael is, I took you out of Egypt, I took you out of Mitzrayim, Beis Avodim, and I did all of these things for you because there is choice. And choice is something that transcends nature. And my relationship to you and your capacity is a capacity that goes beyond nature. And that's what Torah is all about. It's a human being choosing himself in a way in which was not given by our birth status. It's the capacity to raise ourselves and to define ourselves manifold times beyond what the initial definition was.
So where is the manifestation of the realization of choice? Is it when they accept?
Asher haitzei sichem yatz Mitzrayim. When God comes to them, he says to them, I want you to know, I am the Lord your God, and you elected me. Why did you elect me? You elected me because I took you out of Egypt, and I demonstrated to you that you are not just another blind facet of nature which is locked into its fate, but you are capable of emancipating yourself from Eretz Mitzrayim, from Mibbeis Avodim, and because I showed you that it can be done, you then elected to have me as your melech. And now that defines our relationship and your relationship to Tev. You've chosen to attach yourselves to me so that you can redeem yourselves, that you can define yourself, that you can exercise your choice to become things that are not natural, that are extraordinary, that are supernatural. So this is a very important mechilta. The mechilta is telling us that what it means, Anechi Hashem Lekecha, talks about an election, and why he speaks about Heitzeisicha Miatz Mitzrayim Mibeis Avodim rather than talk about heaven and earth. And it's all because there's a necessity here to talk not about things that are locked into nature, but to talk about forces that can rise above nature. And at that point, Klal Yisrael says, Hein Behein. Now we're ready.